Last Sunday, I left off talking about acquiring wealth, and we were looking at some inferior ways of acquiring wealth, and talked about inheritance last time, and as I'm going through these inferior ways of acquiring wealth, they're going to become more inferior as we go down the list, and by the time you get to the end, it's just flat out wrong. You don't acquire wealth this way at all by the time we get to the very last one, but anyway, if you have an outline, let's see, what page are we on? 16. And I'm going to look at, we're going to talk about winning the lottery. This is another inferior way of acquiring wealth. But believe it or not, this is some people's financial plan. There are actually people out there that their plan to get wealthy is to buy lottery tickets. I'm not even making this up. There are people out there that this is what they're hoping for. But winning the lottery will indeed bring a man wealth, you know, one in a million, but it will also often subsequently bring poverty to the people that win it. And I have some, I have a statistic about that here in a second. I did some research on the lottery and lottery winners because I was just curious as to, you know, if it was really a blessing or if it ended up ruining their lives. And my gut intuition was, and just things that you hear, is that it's a, on balance, it's a bad thing, and I think that's probably the case. It's not like it ruins everybody's life, but about half of them at least, it doesn't make them any better off and usually worse off. And the Bible teaches this. In Proverbs 13 and verse 11, if you get wealth by vain means, it will not last. Proverbs 13 and verse 11. Wealth gotten by vanity, uselessness, frivolity. Wealth gotten by vanity shall be diminished, but he that gathereth by labor shall increase. So if you want to increase and build wealth, it's by working, by labor. It's not by getting wealth by vanity, like winning the lottery or something like that. Like I said, I read some articles on lottery winners, and I have a quote here for you that I think was interesting. This is by Abigail Johnson Hess in an article called Why... or Here's Why Lottery Winners Go Broke. This is from 2017. She says, lottery winners are more likely to declare bankruptcy within 3 to 5 years than the average American. What's more, studies have shown that winning the lottery does not necessarily make you happier or healthier. So lottery winners are more likely to declare bankruptcy within 3 to 5 years. So they blow it and they're totally broke, which means that they're worse off than when they started, because when they started, they had the average person's chance of declaring bankruptcy. When they finish winning the lottery, they have a greater chance of declaring bankruptcy. So they're actually worse off on average than before they won the lottery. And then it also, as it says there, doesn't make you happier or healthier. And I'm going to tell you one story about a man. His name's Jack Whitaker, probably the most infamous lottery winner ever. And you can read about him on Wikipedia. There's actually a Wikipedia page dedicated to this poor fellow. He died here a few years ago. He won the Powerball. I think he was from Virginia, somewhere on the East Coast. He won the Powerball in the early 2000s when it was $314.9 million. So it was the greatest Powerball, the highest Powerball ever. He only bought tickets when it was over like $100 million or something like that. And he bought like $100 of tickets or something. Won this thing, 314.9. He ended up getting $113 million in cash, because to get the whole amount, you got to take it in like an annuity, and it's over the course of 30 years and all that. So he took the cash option, and then of course, you know, the tax man's going to take half of it or so. So he ended up with 113. You know, which, you know, if you were careful and pinched your pennies, you could probably live for a few years on that much money, right? And Mr. Whitaker at least put a small hole in my theory, because I had a theory before I read this that somebody who was a self-made millionaire and won the lottery would probably be fine, because a self-made millionaire obviously knows how to manage money and wouldn't be probably destroyed and ruined by it. That was my theory. And a broke person that wins the lottery, it'll probably ruin him, because he doesn't know how to manage money, because that's why he's broke, right? He doesn't know. Well, Mr. Whitaker was already a multimillionaire. He was already worth $17 million. He was a company owner. He had a construction company. And I mean, not he probably didn't have $17 million in the bank, but his whole company, his net worth, you know, $17 million. So he was a wealthy individual to begin with. So he gets this $113 million, and he gives 10% of it to Christian charities. Off to a good start, right? Apparently, he was a believer. Sounds like it, you know. And then he gave, $14 million to create a foundation to help the poor in Appalachia. Another nice thing to do. So he's already gotten rid of 20-some million of it. Then he bought a house and a Jeep Grand Cherokee and gave $44,000 to the deli manager who sold him the ticket. So he gave about $200,000 worth of stuff to the lady that sold him the ticket. It was a nice thing to do. And then he starts to go downhill and he buys himself a Lamborghini. And then he drives his Lamborghini through his neighborhood and he literally throws money out the windows as he's driving through his neighborhood in his Lamborghini. I'm not making this up. It's like an episode in Dumb and Dumber or something, you know? But then it gets worse. Then thieves break into his car. I'm assuming it was his Lambo, but I don't know. But one of his cars, thieves break into his car and steal $545,000 in cash out of his car. He's literally walking around with like a briefcase full of $100 bills, over $500,000 in cash in his car. And when they asked him, why were you carrying over $500,000 in cash in his car? He said, quote, because I can. I mean, I don't blame him. You know, if you're driving around, you go to a yard sale and there happens to be a Rolls Royce and there's a good deal on it. You don't have cash, you might not get it, right? So, I mean, why not carry around $500,000, right? Then thieves broke into his car again and stole $200,000 in cash. He got that back. The police apparently found the thieves. But, you know, as if he didn't learn the first time. But then things go from bad to worse. His granddaughter's boyfriend overdoses in his house and dies, like 18 years old. Then his granddaughter dies. They find her wrapped up in a bag somewhere, either murdered or, you know, drug overdose or something. She dies. Then his daughter's found dead after that. And then his house burns to the ground uninsured. It was just one thing after another. This guy's life was an unmitigated disaster. And it wasn't in the Wikipedia article, but it was in another article that I read about him that he said he wished he'd never bought the darn ticket in the first place. Like, it just totally ruined his life. So that doesn't happen to every lottery winner, but it just shows you that even a man who is successful and apparently pretty wise with money to amass $17 million in his lifetime, even somebody like that can be destroyed by a huge lottery win. And the Bible teaches this. And there's reasons for this. Lottery winners' lives are often ruined due to three things. A lack of money management skills, number one. You know, the foolish man spendeth it up. Number two, friends and family seeking money. And number three, being the target of thieves, which was the case with this guy. Let me just give you a couple of verses here. Proverbs 14 and verse 20. Here's what happens when you win the lottery. The poor is hated even of his own neighbor, but the rich hath many friends. And you might want to put friends in quotes there. The rich hath many friends. When you're wealthy, everybody wants to be your friends. Every man is a friend to him that giveth gifts. Proverbs 19:4. I think that's probably what this... Yeah, that verse 6 is the one I was thinking of. But 4 and 6. Proverbs 19:4 and 6. Wealth maketh many friends, but the poor is separated from his neighbor. And then verse 6. Many will entreat the favor of the prince, and every man is a friend to him that giveth gifts. If you want to have a lot of friends, so-called, just give gifts. Give people money. People like those who give them things. And people like to hang out with the rich. You know, who doesn't like to hang out in a nice house with a nice party and, you know, great food and all that, right? So if you win the lottery, all of a sudden you're going to have a lot of friends hoping to get something from you. And also, the rich are targets of thieves. Proverbs 13 and verse 8. Now, these thieves could be thieves like we think about it in the conventional sense, that break into your house or your car and steal $545 million out of your briefcase. Or they could be thieves like government thieves that come after you because you're rich, right? Or they could be other types, you know, these ambulance chaser lawyer types that are going to file lawsuits against you because you have money. Things like that. You can have all kinds of thieves coming after you. You could have people that would do what they did to Mr. Getty and kidnap his grandson and then ask for a ransom. And this is, I think, sort of what Proverbs 13:8 is referring to. The ransom of a man's life are his riches, but the poor heareth not rebuke. The ransom of a man's life are his riches. He's going to have to pay a ransom, either for his own life or maybe the life of his family or something, because he's rich. How many poor people do you think criminals kidnap their children and say, hey, give me that $100 in your bank account? Nobody's going to do that. Who cares, right? I mean, why would you even risk getting caught over a minuscule amount, even if it's thousands? Who would do that? But if you stand to gain millions from somebody, yeah. If you stand to gain millions, thieves would target somebody like that in some cases. So the only way really to win the lottery, and I'm talking like multiple millions, I'm not talking about a scratch card where you win $500, or I'm not even talking like $50,000, I'm talking like multiple millions, some real money. The only way to win the lottery and it be a blessing to you and not a curse is if you do two things. Number one, you don't change your lifestyle. And number two, you don't tell anybody about it. If you do those two things, you'll be fine. You can take those multiple millions, invest them, live off the dividends, be taken care of the rest of your life. But if you change your lifestyle, number one, the money is going to be gone. Number two, people are going to know that you have money when they see you driving your Lamborghini and living in your big, nice, swanky house and all that. And then that leads to the second problem of people knowing about it. And when people know about it, either by the way you live or if you flat out tell them, then all of a sudden you have all kinds of friends. And you have all kinds of long-lost family members that want to reconnect with you. And everybody's going to want money. So the only way to do it and it not to be a curse, don't change your lifestyle and don't tell anybody. But if you don't do those two things, it's probably not going to turn out very well for you. And this, sadly, most people do not have the wisdom and the self-discipline to do those things. And that's why, at least half of people that win the lottery end up probably wishing that they hadn't, because it just made their life worse in the long run. Now for the next inferior way to acquire wealth, and that is by begging. This is a way to acquire wealth. There are actually people out there that do this for a living, right? Every beggar that you see on the street isn't homeless and fallen on hard times. I've been told, I haven't actually witnessed this, but I've heard stories of people begging and then somebody watches them and follows them and they walk, down the block and get in a nice Suburban and go home to their nice house. There are people that make a career out of it. To beg is to ask alms, or by way of alms, to ask bread, money, etc. in alms or as a charitable gift to procure one's living by begging. And there were people in the Bible that did procure their living by begging, except they were, I think, almost in all cases either crippled or blind or something where they really couldn't work. They didn't have a means of income. And I'll talk about that. It's one thing to beg if you're in that situation. It's another one to beg if it's because you're an idiot. Begging is not an honorable way to acquire wealth. Let's look at Luke 16 and verse 3. Luke 16 and verse 3. This is the parable of the unjust steward. You remember the man, he had wasted his master's goods. And the master says, all right, you're fired. Give me an account of who owes me what and get out of here. You're done. And the steward comes up with a plan because he was too ashamed to beg and he was too lazy to work. So got to do something. So he cut a deal with all the creditors and said, oh, hey, you owe 100, write down 80. You owe 80, write down 50 or whatever. And so he basically cut him a deal. And so he made some friends that might take care of him down the road. But anyway, the only verse that I wanted there was verse 3. Then the steward said within himself, what shall I do? For my Lord taketh away from me the stewardship. I cannot dig. You can't dig? You don't have arms and a leg and legs? You can't dig? No, he doesn't want to dig because he's lazy. I cannot dig. To beg, I am ashamed. And rightly so. You should be ashamed to beg. It's a shameful thing to beg. Unless you're blind and, you know, an invalid or something and you have no other choice. But, you know, if you're able-bodied, it's shameful to beg, as this man says. Now, righteous people and their children will not have to beg. Psalm 37 and verse 25. There's two reasons for this. I'll read you the verse, and then I'll give you the two reasons. Psalm 37 and verse 25. I have been young. This is David, the sweet psalmist of Israel. I have been young, and now I'm old. Yet have I not seen the righteous forsaken, nor his seed begging bread. So David didn't see the righteous and their children begging for bread. And there's a reason for this, like I said. First of all, God promises to provide for the righteous. Proverbs 10 and verse 3. Proverbs 10:3. This is the first reason why the righteous don't beg. Proverbs 10:3. The Lord will not suffer the soul of the righteous to famish, but he casteth away the substance of the wicked. He doesn't suffer the soul of the righteous to famish. He's not going to allow him to go hungry. He's going to take care of him and provide for him. And Philippians 4 and verse 19, familiar verse to all of us. It opens up with but, right, which connects it back to the previous thought. And as I've said before, this just I mentioned this because I never had noticed it. And now once I've noticed it, I like to mention it. This verse, people just give this verse out just to anybody out there, any Tom, Dick, and Harry. But it's actually written, first of all, to a church, but secondly, to a church which supported its minister. He says that no other church communicated with him, giving, that is, concerning giving and receiving, except this church. And he says to this church, the one that supported this minister, the Apostle Paul, but my God shall supply all your need according to his riches and glory by Christ Jesus. So the righteous will be supplied for by God. That's why they won't be begging. But there's a second reason why the righteous won't be begging. And this is because they obey the word of God and work for a living, save money, and spend wisely. That's why they won't be begging also. Because just because you're a Christian who believes the truth, even if you're in a true church, it doesn't necessarily mean you're not going to have financial troubles if you are foolish with money. Right? You can be in a true church, you can be a godly Christian, and you can do a lot of things well, but if you're stupid with your money, it's no guarantee that you're not going to have financial troubles. You can have financial troubles even if you are a Christian in a true church, if you're not doing what God says to do with money. Even if you're tithing, you could be a Christian that tithes everything that he possesses, which is a good godly thing to do. Even if you tithe, if the other 90% of your income you blow like a drunken sailor, like an idiot, guess what? You're going to be broke, even if you tithe. Because God, it's not in the Bible, but it's a principle. God helps those who help themselves, right? When you do what God says, he blesses you. If you don't do what God says regarding your money, you're not going to be blessed with your money. You know, tithing is good, but that's only part of the equation. Don't just think, oh, I'm going to tithe, and then I'm just going to blow the rest of my money, and everything's going to be fine. It might not be fine, right? You need to do the rest of what God says with money, too. God expects you to be prudent and to be a good steward of what he's given you. And so, therefore, when you have the blessing of God in your life and you do what God says regarding money, you are not going to be begging bread. You're not going to have, you're not going to be in financial straits. Now, if you don't work when you should, you might end up having to resort to this ignominious practice of begging someday. Proverbs 20 and verse 4. Proverbs 20 and verse 4. I don't know about you, but I don't ever want to be begging. I mean, I don't want to be sitting on the side of the road begging. I don't want to be knocking on doors of family members, friends, church members, anybody else, and begging and asking for money. I don't, you know, I hope it would never come down to that. I mean, maybe it would. Maybe some terrible calamity would happen to me and I'd get some horrible disease and I'd be completely broke and my house burns down or whatever. I'm not saying it could never happen, but what I am saying is, I'm going to do everything within my power with the help of God so that I never have to knock on somebody's door asking for money. Proverbs 20 and verse 4. The sluggard will not plow by reason of the cold. Therefore shall he beg and harvest and have nothing. See, he wouldn't work. He was supposed to be working. He was supposed to be plowing. Yeah, it's cold, right? Sometimes springtime when you need to plow, it's cold. Yeah, it's raining. It's not fun. It's miserable. I don't feel like it. I'll get to it next week. I'll get to it next week. I'll get to it next week. And before you know it, it's June. And guess what? It's too late to plant now. And guess what happens in harvest? You wasted your time in early on in the year. And now what? Now you're begging in harvest. This is what a lot of people do when you think about their life as a whole. They waste their time for a good chunk of their life in the beginning and live like fools, and then harvest time comes and they're like, oh, now what am I going to do? That's why I'm preaching this sermon. I don't want that to happen to you. I've told you the story before, but I have a little note here next to that verse. Working on the Escort in a snowstorm. One time I was driving my car home and it was running terribly. It was missing on one of the cylinders, which only had four. So when it's missing on one, it's you know, pretty bad. And I get home, it's this awful snowstorm, and went in my house, and I didn't have a garage or anything. So, and it's parked up in the yard, and I get home and get warmed up. I'm thinking, that car's an old piece of junk anyway, whatever. I don't care. I'm just going to drive it. It blows up, whatever. I'll just buy another one. And then that verse came to mind. I kid you not. The sluggard will not plow by reason of the cold. Therefore shall he beg and harvest and have nothing. So I put my clothes back on. I traipsed up through the snow. I opened the hood. And don't you know, all it was the grommet that holds the spark plug wires had fallen off. And the spark plug wire was laying on the exhaust manifold. It just melted through and it was just shorting out to the exhaust manifold. Just picked it up, stuck it back in the slot, and it was fine. You know, a little 10-second fix saved me buying a new car. You know, so anyway, moral of the story is memorize scripture, because sometimes a verse that has even nothing to do with what you're actually dealing with will come to mind and it'll save you buying another car. Now, if a man begs, like I said, because he's blind or incapable of providing for himself, that's one thing. You know, we have examples of that in the Bible. I'll give you a couple here in a second. But if he begs due to laziness or foolish choices, that's another thing. Now, let's look at Mark 10 and verse 46. You know, if I see a guy on the sidewalk and he's in a wheelchair and he's incapable of, you know, he's got no family or something, what other choice does he have but to beg? You know, that's one thing. When I see an able-bodied man that could be working is just lazy, that's another thing. I'm not going to help out that guy. Mark 10 and verse 46. And they came to Jericho, and as he went out of Jericho with his disciples, a great number of people, blind Bartimaeus, the son of Timaeus, sat by the highway side begging. So here's a blind man begging. Now, it's pretty hard to do much of any work when you're blind. I mean, there's limited things. Today, in our society, there probably is work for the blind. I mean, there's work for just about anybody. There's something that you could do. But in those days, there's probably very little that a blind man could do. He had no choice but to beg. John 9 and verse 8 is another example of another blind man that was a beggar. And the neighbors thereof, this is the man that was born blind, Jesus healed him. And the neighbors therefore, and they which before had seen him that was blind, said, is not this he that sat and begged? So yeah, if you're blind, you get a pass. You can be a beggar if you're blind. But if you can see and you have, you know, the rest of your faculties so that you can work, you ought to be working. And then that brings us to the last method of acquiring wealth. And this one is absolutely a no-go. And that is theft. It is a way of acquiring wealth. There was an old bank robber. I forget which one it was. And they asked him, why do you rob banks? And he said, that's where the money is. Right? So, you know, that is a way. You know, there have been men that have, you know, been successful at that for a while, but you usually get caught. Remember what God says about this? Everybody knows, Ten Commandments, Exodus 20 and verse 15, thou shalt not steal. All right, we all know that one. But the thing is, theft can take many forms, other than outright forcibly breaking into somebody's house or somebody's car and stealing their money or holding them at gunpoint. It can also take the form of fraud, you know, ripping people off. That's theft, right? Lots of people do that these days. Unjust lawsuits, right? That's theft. If you get into a car accident and you have $10,000 of medical bills and you sue somebody for $10,000, perfectly fine, right? That's called restitution. Nothing wrong with that whatsoever. And if you had $10,000 in medical bills and you were off work for 3 months and you sue them for the money that you would have made in those 3 months, right? Fine and dandy. But if you have $10,000 in medical expenses and you sue them for $1 million, you are a thief. That's what you are. You're a thief. You just stole $990,000. Is that right? Yeah, no, I think it's right anyway. You just stole a bunch of money. And so is the lawyer that you hired. Fraud, unjust lawsuits. And how about this one? Voting for politicians who would steal other people's money through taxation and give it to you. Those are all forms of theft. Right? There's just layers removed. I vote for this thief and he steals on my behalf. And when you consider that definition of theft, there are a lot of people receiving stolen property in this country. Horace Greeley said, "The darkest hour of any man's life is when he sits down to plan how to get money without earning it." I thought that was pretty good. All right, so now I've talked about acquiring wealth. Like I said, in this study, I'm trying to go about this in logical order. All right, so if we're dealing with money and wealth, well, the first thing is you got to get some. You got to acquire some, right? Well, then the next logical thing would be saving. That is, if you're smart, that's the next logical thing. That's not what most people do when they make money, but that's the next logical thing that should be done. Now, I was thinking about this, and I thought, you know, if the average American were preaching this sermon, the order would be a little different. The order would be, number one, borrowing money. You say, well, who borrows money before they make it? They're called college students. They take out massive college debt, student loan debt, to go to college. So the first thing that we encourage our young people to do today, before they even earn a penny, is go out and take on a bunch of debt, right? So number one, borrowing money. Number two, acquiring money. After you graduate college, then you can make a little bit if you can find a job with that worthless degree that you got in many cases. Number three, then it's spending money, right? So the next thing you do as soon as you acquire money is you spend it. That's number three on most Americans' list of things to do. And then number four is borrowing more money. So we started off borrowing money, then we make a little bit of money, then we spend all the money we made, then we borrow more money for the car payment, the house payment, the furniture, the credit cards, right, and so on. And then comes number five, that would be saving the little pittance that's left, if there happens to be any, which, you know, for most people is nothing. And I'm not making this up, I have stats to prove it, which I'll give to you later today yet. So, you know, the logical sequence in American culture would be different than the sequence that I'm going through today. But the proper order is making money and then saving money. That's the first thing you should do. When you get paid, the first thing you should do, well, actually, the first thing you should do is give to the Lord. That should be number one. Number one item on your budget. The next thing you should do is save. Now, what most people do is they get the money and they spend it all. And if there's anything left, then they save, right? That's not how you do it. First thing you do is save automatically. And then you live on the rest. You force yourself to live on the rest. But I'll talk about that later. But saving is hard. Saving is hard. You know that? You probably do. I mean, anybody that's done it knows saving is hard. And that's because doing the right thing is always hard. You ever notice that? Doing the right thing is always hard. And doing the wrong thing is almost always easy in the short term. In the short term, doing the right thing is hard. Doing the wrong thing is easy. That's why most people do the wrong thing, right? Think about it. Saving is hard. You have to defer what you want right now. You have to delay your gratification. You have to postpone the thing you want to buy until you actually have the money to buy it, right? That's hard. It's easy to swipe the card, right? I don't have the money. I don't want to wait. I swipe the card. But you know what's hard? Paying 18 or 25% interest for the rest of your life on all the dumb stuff you put on your card that you couldn't afford. That's what's hard, and being broke your entire life. It's easy to sign your name on the car loan. It's hard to overpay for that car for the next 5 years and then get yourself in a cycle of debt for the rest of your life. Right? It's easy to follow your lusts and have sex with your girlfriend before you get married. It's easy to do that. It's the natural thing. It's hard to wait until you get married. But you know what's harder? To suffer with a venereal disease. To have a child out of wedlock. To have a screwed up psyche because of what you've done. You know, doing the right thing is always hard. Doing the easy thing is usually wrong. So saving is hard. It requires sacrifice, self-denial, and discipline, which is why most people don't do much of it. And I have the stats to prove it. I'm not making this up, right? I'll give you the stats. Most Americans, anyway. Sacrifice, self-denial, and discipline. That's what it takes to save. But saving pays off later by giving you a blessed life of peace, satisfaction, fulfillment, and opportunity. It gives you all those things. Peace, you don't have to worry about money. You don't have to worry about being broke. You don't have to worry about your check bouncing, if whatever, because you barely have enough money in the account or whatever. You don't got to worry about any of that stuff. Gives you satisfaction, the satisfaction of working and saving and looking at that bank account and seeing, wow, there's something there. Like that feels good, like I've actually accomplished something. It gives you fulfillment and opportunity. You realize that when you have money saved, you have a lot more opportunities, right? Something comes up. If you have the money, you can do things that you wouldn't otherwise be able to do. Maybe a business opportunity comes up. Maybe a really good deal on something that you'd really like to have comes up, and you've got the money and you can do it. You don't have the money, you lose all those opportunities. Thomas J. Stanley, in his book, The Millionaire Next Door, which I've quoted from quite a bit and I will continue to, Lord willing, he said, most of us want to be wealthy, but most of us do not spend the time, energy, and money required to enhance our chances of realizing this goal. It takes work. Saving is hard. And discipline is key. This is from Dave Ramsey's book, Dave Ramsey's Complete Guide to Money. That's the second book that I recommend that you read after his first book on the Total Money Makeover. But he said this: when it comes to saving money and building wealth over the long haul, nothing is more important than discipline. And I agree with him. Discipline is the most important thing. You don't have to have many brain cells. It doesn't take any brain cells to save money. I mean, you realize an amoeba could pretty much figure out how to save money. It's really simple. You just don't spend it. That's all. You take part of your money and you set it aside and you say, I'm not going to touch this. Right? I mean, it takes the IQ of an amoeba to be able to figure that out. But it takes discipline. Discipline, that's the hard part. Where you have to tell yourself, no, I will not spend that money. I will set aside this percentage and I will not spend it. It's for the future. It takes discipline. Ramsey goes on to say, too many people skip the discipline and try to go straight to the enjoyment. That's a recipe for disaster. This is why Americans are such a mess. Skip the discipline, go right to the enjoyment. I want it. Swipe the card. I want it. Sign my name on the line. I want it. I want it. I want it. I don't want to wait. I don't want to discipline myself. That's how so many people get hooked on playing the lottery or go broke in a horrible get-rich-quick scheme that falls apart. Wealth building is a marathon, not a sprint. There really aren't any shortcuts. That's why most people don't do it. If building wealth were easy, everyone would be rich, and that's very true. I really like what he said there. There really aren't any shortcuts. There aren't any shortcuts to building wealth. It's just day after day, living under your means, saving money, laying it up day after day, week after week, month after month, year after year, decade after decade. There are no shortcuts. There's no magic bullet. There's no special thing that you can do. It's just a life of frugality and discipline and wisdom, and it's every day making the right decision and just slowly laying up and investing, and then your money can start to make money on its own. But there's no easy way. It's like losing weight. There's no easy way to lose weight, right? Everybody wants the, what is it? What's that stupid weight loss drug? Ozempia? Oh, I forget what it's called. Ozempia? Something like that. Those things are all bound to fail. And that drug is very bad, by the way. Go look that up sometime. But anyway, there's no easy way. There's no pill. You know what you do to lose weight? It's very simple. It's not easy, but it's very simple. You burn more calories than you eat. Very simple. There's your weight loss plan. Every single person on the face of the earth can lose weight by doing one thing. Burning more calories than you eat. I didn't say it's easy. I said it's simple. There's a difference. Simple, not easy. But, you know, why are people overweight? Same reason. No discipline. They want to eat more than they should, and they want to eat stuff that they shouldn't. What if you squeezed an extra $100 out of your budget every month? If you save just $100 a month, every month, from age 25 to age 65, your working lifetime, at the stock market average return of 12%, you'd retire with more than $1.1 million. You'd be a millionaire with just $100 a month. You realize that? Save $100 a month, every month, from age 25 to 65, if you could make the stock market average of 12%, which, you know, that's debatable. But if you could, theoretically, and over time, the stock market, the S&P, does average out 12% per year. If you did that, $100 a month, you'd be a millionaire by the time you're 65. You know, if you just do it and you start young, it doesn't really take a whole lot, assuming, you know, some assumptions. And then Stanley in The Millionaire Next Door, again, wrote concerning this. He said, how do you become wealthy? Here, too, most people have it wrong. It is seldom by luck or inheritance or advanced degrees or even intelligence that enables people to amass fortunes. Wealth is more often the result of a lifestyle of hard work, perseverance, planning, and most of all, self-discipline. See, he agrees with Ramsey, and I agree with both of them. Self-discipline. That's the most important thing. Here's a quote from Jerzy Grigoryk. This is one of my wife's favorite quotes. Easy choices, hard life. Hard choices, easy life. Easy choices, hard life. You make the easy choices, you do what's easy, your life's going to be tough. It'll feel great in the beginning, but it's going to be tough at the end. You make the hard choices throughout your life, it's going to make your life easy at the end. All other things being equal. Of course, life is not easy, period, but it can be a lot less easy than... if you live foolishly. Here's one of my favorite quotes, and if you read Ramsey's Total Money Makeover, you'll see it literally on every page because it's in the footer of every page. This is Ramsey's signature quote. If you will live like no one else, later you can live like no one else. This is what I tell to every young person out there. If you will live like no one else now, later you can live like no one else. But the problem is, people, especially when they're young, and most people even when they're old, they want to live like everyone else. They want to live like the Joneses. They want to go in debt like everybody else. They want to finance everything like everyone else. They don't want to save like everyone else. And guess what? They're going to be living like everyone else too. Ramsey continues, he says, if you will make the sacrifices now that most people aren't willing to make, later on you will be able to live as those folks will never be able to live. He says, also in that book, winning at money is 80% behavior and 20% head knowledge. What to do isn't the problem. Doing it is. Most of us know what to do, but we just don't do it. And that's so true. Winning at money is 80% behavior. It's not a matter of really knowing what to do. If you think about it, building wealth is not rocket science. Every one of you know how to do it. Every single one of you know how to do it. Every person on this earth, I would venture to guess, that has an IQ above 50 knows how to build wealth. You know how you do it? You spend less than you make. That's it. You spend less than you make. You live on less than you make. A lot less, as a matter of fact. That's all. I mean, it is that one simple thing. Everybody knows that. But why don't people have even a little bit of wealth in this country? Because they don't do it. It's not that they don't know it. Everybody knows what to do. Spend less than you make. People don't do it. That's the problem. The millionaire next door chimes in on this. What we have discovered, or what have we discovered in all of our research? Mainly that building wealth takes discipline, sacrifice, and hard work. Do you really want to become financially independent? Are you and your family willing to reorient your lifestyle to achieve this goal? Many will likely conclude they are not. And I would say many will say they are, but they actually won't. Right? Many, I want to do that. Yeah, I'm going to do that, right. But most people won't. If you are willing to make the necessary trade-offs of your time, energy, and consumption habits, however, you can begin building wealth and achieving financial independence. And then later on in the book, it says, what if your goal is to become financially independent? Your plan should be to sacrifice high consumption today for financial independence tomorrow. And that's why it's so important. I keep saying it's so important to start young, because if you start saving money and investing money young, you have the power of interest working for you, and it goes crazy. It will go exponential, compound interest. But what most people do is the exact opposite. They go into debt young, and they pay compound interest and keep themselves broke their whole lives. So important to start young, and so few people do it. And that's why Americans are in the shape they're in. But the key to it is start now, whether you're young or old. This is from Ramsey again in his Complete Guide to Money. He says, the trick is, though, that you have to start right now! Exclamation point. No matter how young or how old you are, all the time you have is all the time you have. You have to start where you are. So if you're under 25, stop thinking you have all the time in the world. And if you're over 40, do not let regret keep you from getting this stuff going now. You have plenty of time left. It's never too late to start moving in the right direction. And he's absolutely right. That's what young people think. I've got my whole life. I'm not worried about it. Oh, I can save for retirement later. And then when you get to be over 40 and you look and there's hardly anything in your retirement and you think, oh man, I just blew the last 20 years. What's the point of even starting? No, there is a point in starting. Start now. Start today. Start today. And the scripture teaches this principle. Hebrews 3 and verse 15. Some of these sermons have a lot of Bible in them. Some of them don't have as much. But I try to make sure that everything that I'm teaching you is based on biblical principle. Sometimes I just really start going off and giving examples and reading quotes and giving you personal advice or whatever, but I always try to base it on the foundation of Scripture, even if I don't necessarily give you a lot of Bible in every single sermon. Hebrews 3 and verse 15. While it is said today, if you will hear his voice, harden not your hearts, as in the provocation. Now, he's not encouraging them to invest in their retirement in Hebrews chapter 3, but the principle's there. Today, while you hear his voice, you're hearing the sermon. The Bible teaches to save money. I've given you that already. I'll give you some more of it. Well, start today. Today. Now, I want to do something a little bit different in this sermon today, and I hope you don't think me a fool for doing it. I do have biblical precedent for it. I want to tell you this story, tell you my life story of frugality and saving. And I have a purpose for doing that. It's not to preach myself. And I will give you, I'll get into the purpose here in just a second. I came across a quote, though, in The Millionaire Next Door. And I thought, boy, this really sums it up. And I thought, this is a commentary on my entire adult life. One sentence. Whatever your income, always live below your means. Whatever your income, always live below your means. And if you do that, all other things being equal, should turn out pretty well for you. Now, why would I tell you my life story about frugality and saving? Why would I do that? It's because I'm supposed to be your example in all areas of life, not just in Bible knowledge, not just in prayer, not just in spiritual things necessarily, but I'm supposed to be your example in all areas. And if you think that that's a great job to have, just think about that for a while. Think about if you wanted your job to be an example to other people in everything. And think about how weighty of a responsibility that is and how much you probably would not like it. And then you'll get an idea of how much I love my job. Sort of. I do like my job sometimes. But this part of it's not fun. Not fun. Because you know how hard it is for you to do the right thing and for you to be an example to others? You know how hard it is for you to do it? It's just as hard for me to do it. You realize when you're ordained, it's not like you just get some magical angelic nature where you're just different than everybody else and, oh, it's just easy for you. You can just keep all the commandments flawlessly and be an example. I'm just like you are. I'm like no different whatsoever. I've got the same struggles, temptations, problems. I'm just like you. But God tells me to be an example. Think about that. I mean, that's hard. That's a tough act. And obviously, I don't do a great job of it. Try, but, you know, it's tough. 1 Timothy 4 and verse 12. Let no man despise thy youth, but be thou an example of the believers. See, even a young pastor is supposed to be an example to the believers. That could be old believers. You know, think about it. You know, a young man ordained in his 20s, God says you be an example to these older people. Think about that. I mean, that's really something. Be thou an example to the believers in word, in conversation. Conversation, if you didn't know 1611 English, you'd think, well, that's the same as word. No, it's not the same as word. Conversation is the action of living or having one's being in a place or among persons. It's your manner of life. It's how you live. Be an example in how you live, in charity, in spirit, in faith, in purity, he says. 1 Peter 5 and verse 3. I'm giving you all these verses because I'm honestly a little bit scared that you might think you're just up here trying to preach yourself or boast about whatever, and that's not what I'm doing. So I'm giving you all these verses, and I'm making all these apologies before I do what I'm about ready to do. 1 Peter 5 and verse 3. He's talking to the elders among them. Neither is being lords over God's heritage, but being ensamples, which is an old word which means examples, but being ensamples to the flock. So a pastor is supposed to be an example. And church members are supposed to consider the conversation, that is the manner of life of their pastor, and follow it. Hebrews 13 and verse 7. Hebrews 13 and verse 7. Remember them which have the rule over you, who have spoken unto you the word of God. So we're talking about the preachers, right? The preachers are the ones that have the rule, and the preachers are the ones that do the preaching. Speak unto you the word of God. Whose faith follow, considering the end of their conversation, their manner of life. You see, your faith isn't just the things that you believe about God. Your faith should influence your whole life. It should influence your manner of life, your conversation, how you live. And you're supposed to follow that in your pastor. Now, here's the thing. You would not be aware of the example that I've set in some areas of my life unless I tell you about it, right? For one thing, a lot of what I'm going to tell you happened before you knew me. You'd have no way of knowing any of this because you've only known me for, you know, 12 years or so, or maybe 15 if you count when you saw me a couple of times in Minneapolis before I was your pastor. But you haven't known me for that long. I had a lot of life before you ever met me or knew me. So you wouldn't know any of that stuff. And honestly, it's not like I'm sending you financial reports or something. I mean, you don't really know, and I'm not going to give you financial reports. I'm not going to give you a bunch of numbers. I'll give you a couple of them early on in life just to make a point. So if I didn't tell you, you wouldn't really know necessarily. And furthermore, telling my life story to you is actually biblical. Did you know that? It's biblical for a preacher to tell his story to his church. I'm not going to read all these verses, but Paul did this on numerous occasions. I'll just read you this one, Philippians 3, 4 through 8. Philippians 3, 4 through 8. And this is the same Paul which said, "We preach not ourselves, but Christ Jesus the Lord." And yet Paul, on many occasions, gave stories of his life to the people that he wrote to. Philippians 3, 4 through 8. "Though I might also have confidence in the flesh, if any other man thinketh that he hath whereof he might trust in the flesh, I am more, circumcised the eighth day, of the stock of Israel, the tribe of Benjamin, and Hebrew of the Hebrews, as touching the law, a Pharisee, concerning zeal, persecuting the church, touching the righteousness which is in the law, blameless. But what things were gained to me, those I counted loss for Christ. Yea, doubtless, and I count all things, but loss for the excellency of the knowledge of Christ Jesus my Lord, for whom I have suffered the loss of all things, and do count them but dung, that I may win Christ." So here he's telling him his pedigree, telling him his history, right? In some places, Paul even said it was confident boasting, and he wasn't going to allow anybody to stop his boasting. Now, I don't want to get up here and boast. That's certainly not the point. But Paul wasn't even afraid to really put it out there sometimes. A couple other examples are Galatians 1, 13 through 24. I'm not going to read the passage, but he recounts the story, part of the story of his conversion there. 2 Corinthians 11, 21 through 33. He talks about all of the suffering that he endured, all the things that he went through, and he gives a lot of information about his life. Acts 22, 1 through 21, he asks to speak to the Jews when they've taken custody of him, and he gives them his whole conversion story, right? He tells his story to them. So there's nothing wrong with a pastor doing this. And I thought of another verse this morning, which kind of sums this up, in 2 Timothy 3 and verse 10. 2 Timothy 3 and verse 10. He writes to Titus, and this was not unique to Titus. Okay, he did this, like he told Titus, what am I talking about? Timothy. That's why the book's called Timothy. It's written to Timothy, right? This wasn't unique to Timothy. Paul made known this to everybody. Look at what he says here. 2 Timothy 3:10. "But thou hast fully known my doctrine, manner of life, purpose, faith, long-suffering, charity, patience." He says, you've fully known my manner of life. You know a lot about me. You know how I live my life. That would include Paul's finances. Paul talks about his finances. He said, "I know how to abase, I know how to abound." Right? He said he profited in the Jews' religion. Paul talked about his finances. He said he was, he talked about how he worked, sometimes to provide for himself. He didn't take anything from the church to make a point. I mean, he said he had power to require money of them, but he didn't do it sometimes. Paul talked about his finances, right? So there's nothing wrong with telling a story, I don't think. I don't know about you, I like reading biographies, autobiographies. I like reading the stories of people's lives. I like hearing the stories of people's lives. But if you don't, I will permit you to go to sleep now. You can go to sleep. I won't even yell at you. And I'll wake you up at the end, okay? It's okay, seriously. Let me take a drink of water. I think the Lord gave me a gift when I was young. I think he gave me the gift of financial sense. I really do. I don't take credit for it. Even from the time I was little, somebody gave my brother and I each 2 50-cent pieces. And I used to collect coins. I had a little coin box and a little safe. But anyway, we were little. I was maybe 6 or 7 probably. My brother would have been 4 or 5. Had 2 50-cent pieces. And I saved both of my 50-cent pieces. I had both of them. My brother spent one of his. Okay. I was telling my parents that I had both of my 50-cent pieces. I said, I've got both. I've got 2 50-cent pieces. My brother says, I've got 2 50-cent pieces also. I said, no, you don't. You spent one of yours. No, I've got two of them. Like, show me them. He puts his hands behind his back, and he pulls out his right hand and opens it up. There's a 50-cent piece. Show me the other one. He puts his hand behind his back. He pulls out his left hand, opens it up. There's a 50-cent piece. Show them both at the same time, Brett. He says, no, Shad, only one. So, from a young age, I was a saver. Now, I went through a period of stupidity from ages 16 to 17. And I spent a bunch of money. I spent my money on stereo equipment. I used to really be into car stereos. But then, thankfully, that was the end of my financial stupidity. Pretty much from my 18th birthday, I, for whatever reason, and I wasn't really taught this. I didn't really have this as an example or anything else. But for whatever reason, I just became a frugal saver from my 18th birthday. I joined the Army when I was 17. I went to basic training. The first day of basic training was my 18th birthday. And all the money I made in basic training and all the money I made in AIT, I saved it, like almost all of it. And by the end of that time, it was like 5.5 months, I think, I had like $4,000. I had $4,000 saved in my bank account. Now, everybody saves money in basic training because you can't spend it. There's nothing to spend it on. But then when people get to AIT, they blow it like drunken sailors, right? But I didn't. I didn't spend hardly any money. My friends went to the mall. They went and bought clothes and shoes and went out for drinks and whatever else. I've probably spent a little bit, but I had about $4,000 when I came home. Now, that doesn't sound like a whole lot of money until you realize this was 25 years ago. I was making under $1,000 a month. Do the math. 5 months at under $1,000 a month minus some taxes, I basically saved the entire thing, right? And then I was telling my battle buddy, right before we got to go home, I was telling him how much money I had saved, and I'm going to keep this money. Oh, you won't be able to do that. You're going to go home, you're going to have to buy a car, you're going to have to do this, you're going to have to spend it, you won't be able to save that. I'm like, no, I'm going to save it. So then I got home. A couple of months later, I started college, and I joined the Army for the college money. I was not patriotic. I did not do this for noble reasons. I wasn't trying to serve my country. I was trying to serve myself. I needed college money. My parents didn't pay for a penny of my college and told me that they couldn't, and it was on me, and that was the only way that I was going to probably be able to do it. So joined the Army, and as I went through college, I got the GI Bill, which was $250 a month. I got the GI Bill kicker, which was another $200 a month. I got tuition, I think it was called tuition assistance or reimbursement, which was, I think, $3,500 a year. They would pay of my tuition, and then they had $20,000 loan repayment that they would pay also. But the thing is, you had to take out the loans to get the loan repayment. They don't repay loans if you don't have loans, right? And so I took out student loans. So when I tell you, I've told you in the past that I've never had any debt, I've never taken on debt, never had any kind of... Well, what I mean by that is, yes, I did technically have student loans that I took out that so the Army would pay them. I never made a payment on them. They paid them. My dad took out some Parent Plus loans. The Army paid those too. He didn't pay them. I think I may have paid some interest on them because I think he had to pay the interest on the loans. While I was in school, I didn't have to pay anything, if I remember right. Anyway, thanks to my mother, she did all this paperwork in the Army, and I can really thank her. I wouldn't have been able to do all that stuff. I was busy in engineering school, and the paperwork was a monstrosity, and she did all that for years. And I got every penny out of the Army that they promised me. The reason they promise kids all this stuff is because most people never do the paperwork. They never get it. If you have a mother like mine, you could get it. Anyway, and then I got some scholarships. And if you overpay, the school will, they'll refund the money to you, right? So I got some scholarships over the years. And I worked part-time in a tutoring center. I worked in a stereo shop. I worked during the summers and made some money towards it. But by the time I graduated, this is the last figure I'm going to give you, but by the time I graduated college at 22 years old, I had $20,000 in the bank and no debt. It's amazing. It's amazing. It was the grace of God. It was my mother, God being merciful to me through my mother, getting that money from the Army. But I didn't blow it. Like most college kids would have just blown it. They'd have just, you know, they got out with nothing, right? But I was frugal, disciplined, right? And that's what I'm trying to, the point of telling you this story is like, it can be done, right? It can be done. So then when I got out of college, then I got deployed. I was deployed for a year. I came back. I started working as an engineer, making pretty decent money. I mean, I wasn't making huge money, but, you know, for starting out in the field and where I lived, I was making decent money. And I was living in a house that my dad owned that he was going to give me, that when I moved away, he gave to my brother, which is perfectly fine. That's what he should have done. But I was living there for insurance and property tax bill, which was like $100 a month or something. It was like next to nothing. My dad, that's all he charged me. And I just started socking money away. I was just living like I was making minimum wage, just socking money away, maxing out my 401k at work. I remember meeting with a financial advisor at work. He's looking, and it was like 20%, I think, was the max. And I was just putting it all in there. And he's like, call me back when you have your first million or whatever. I was only there for a year and a half, so it didn't amount to a whole lot. But anyway, like, that's what I was doing. I was driving an old car. I'll get to the car thing later, because the car thing is a big part of the puzzle with most people. Well, then a year and a half later, I moved to Cincinnati to be a resident member of the church down there, and I got another job, and I was making significantly more money. Now, what did I do? Did I take that extra money that I was making and go blow it on a nice car or whatever? No, I just continued to save. I just lived at the same level that I'd always lived at. Like, I never changed my standard of living. I just saved more money. Wanted to buy a house. And eventually I wanted to buy a nice car. And I thought, okay, I'm going to buy, when I say a nice car, I wanted to buy like a used little sports car for 20 grand or less. So I started putting money away for that. And eventually, when I could have bought the car, I'm like, I don't want to do that. That'd be stupid. That'd be a waste of my money. And didn't do it. But anyway, the only dumb thing I ever did, I bought a crotch rocket when I got home from Iraq. The first thing they told you to do is don't buy a crotch rocket when you get home. And the first thing I did was buy a crotch rocket. I paid cash for it, right? But, you know, that wasn't the best idea. But anyway, so then I got another. After a year in Cincinnati, that 2008 financial crisis happened. Lost my job at that company. Got another job shortly thereafter, making even more money. What did I do? I just saved the extra money. Never changed my spending habits whatsoever. And that's the thing to do. Don't change your spending habits. The more money you make, you save more, you don't spend more. That's how you get ahead. Well, then, after 5 years down there, I was ordained and I went to Minneapolis. And guess what? I wasn't making good money anymore. I wasn't making hardly any money. Like, I was making, I won't tell you how much it was because you'd be, like, your jaw would hit the floor, but I was making, like, almost nothing in the very beginning. By the first year, it was better. I could actually live on it. But what did I do? What spending habits did I change? Nothing really, because I was already living at subsistence level before that, right? I probably, instead of going out to eat once a week, I just didn't go out to eat at all. I mean, that was about it. I mean, there was nothing else to cut out. I didn't spend any money, and I never really had spent much of any money. I'm not telling you that this is the example you have to follow. I mean, I realize, like, on the continuum here, like, I'm the whole way on this end, and, you know, I'm not telling you that this is the pattern to follow. I'm just showing you what can be done if you choose to. But when I got to Minneapolis, no big deal. I mean, when I took an enormous pay cut, I was just living like I was always living. Lived in the cheapest apartment that I could find there. Oh, when I moved to Cincinnati, I got the cheapest apartment I could find. $400 a month. It'd be a lot more than that now. But in those days, you know, $400 a month, my friends all had either nice houses or a lot more expensive apartments. I lived in the cheapest little apartment that I could find because I had a goal. I had a vision. I wanted to save money. I didn't want to have any debt, right? I moved apartments, moved to where the town where the pastor lived and my friends lived. Again, $410 a month. By the time I left there, I think it was $420. Cheap little apartment, which for somebody I was making good money. I wasn't making crazy money, but I was making good money. I was living way below my means. Nobody in that apartment complex nobody would have been living there. Nobody that I was working with would have been living in that apartment complex. Not a chance, right? But I had a goal and I had a vision. So then when I moved to Minneapolis and I had to live in the cheapest apartment that I could find, or just about the cheapest, no big deal. You know? And then we bought a trailer. After I got married, we bought a trailer, paid cash for that. It was an old trailer, and only had that for 6 months. And thankfully, I was able to sell it for more than I paid for it, which is downright odd with a trailer, but didn't really lose any money on that deal. Moved down here, and guess what? Took another big pay cut because I didn't have any, you know, the support of the people in Minneapolis anymore. And moved into a cheapest apartment I could find. Oh, and up there, I lived in a one-bedroom apartment. And when we got married, I continued to live in a one-bedroom apartment. Mind you, I worked from home. My big, great big L-shaped desk that I have, I think you've all seen that, that used to be in the living room of my apartment. My living room was my office. Before I got married, I moved that into the bedroom, pushed the bed over against the wall, and here I am in this little bedroom. My nightstand for my bed was the side of my desk, right? My desk was up against my bed, and the bed was up against the wall. I'm in this crammed little thing, and this is where I spent, like, most of my waking hours. Could have got a two-bedroom apartment. I just didn't feel like it. I couldn't, you know, money was tight. I didn't want to spend the extra money, and I didn't want to go through the hassle of moving either. But anyway, lived in that little place. And then moved down here, got a little apartment, and have been in it for 7 years. Life didn't turn out like I thought it would. I had planned to buy a house a long time ago. But as I've thought about this, it was the circumstances. When I was in Pennsylvania, I didn't need to buy a house. I already had a free one, right? Didn't end up getting that because I moved. And then so when I moved to Cincinnati, I thought about buying a house. I even started making plans to build a house. But as it turned out, I knew I was going to be ordained and be moving. It just wouldn't have made any sense. I'd have just took out a loan. I'd have paid, you know, the first several years of the loan is just all interest anyway. I just paid a bunch of interest. It would have been a waste of time. When I went to Minneapolis, I was broke. Probably couldn't have got a loan anyway because I didn't have any money. I mean, any income, that is. And I was only there for 5 years. And if I would have ended up buying a house, I'd have just paid a bunch of interest anyway and wouldn't have been any better off. When I moved down here, I was hoping to buy a house soon. And then the pandemic hit and housing prices exploded, like doubled pretty much. And all of a sudden it's like, whoa. So that threw a wrench in the plans. So that's why I've been waiting for 25 years to buy a house, because, you know, life doesn't always work out the way that you had thought that it would. But anyway, getting back to the car thing, that's another piece of this puzzle. When I was 16, my mother bought me a car. I think it was like $1,000, something like that. And that was my first car. My parents should have made me save money and buy it myself. But, you know, like I said, I was an idiot in those days when I was 16 and 17. And so anyway, my mom bought me this car. And then I totaled it on a deer about a year later. Got the insurance money. It was probably like $1,000. Bought a car off my dad. He had a Z24 Cavalier, a little 87. Bought that for like $1,300. So I put a little bit of money towards it and bought that with cash. Then my brother totaled that car for me. Here about a couple of years later, I put quite a few miles on it. And then I bought an Escort, a 94 Ford Escort, when I was in college, $2,000 paid cash for it. Drove that thing for 100,000 miles. Even when I got deployed to the Army after I graduated college, this car is pretty much on its last leg. I thought, I'll just give it to my dad, because if it sits here for a year, it won't probably be even running anymore. I'll give it to my dad. He likes to drive old clunkers. So he drove it for a whole year. He put 15,000 miles on that thing. I hadn't changed the oil in 10,000 miles. I was busy. He drove it for 15 without changing the oil. So it had 25,000 miles on the oil whenever I got back. And the ignition had gone bad. So he was starting it with a screwdriver and whatever else. Anyway, so I got home from overseas, and I was like, well, I need a car. And my old Escort's sitting there. I'm like, hey, Dad, can I have my car back? Sure. So I got my old Escort back. So I'm working as an engineer, driving a 94 Ford Escort. This is in 2006, right? So driving a 12-year-old, two-door, little piece of crap Ford Escort, because why not? Why would I go out and waste money on a car? And I drove that, and I said, I'm going to drive that until I get a girlfriend, because I don't want some girl interested in me because I have a nice car, right? So I'm going to drive this thing until I get a girlfriend, and then I'll know if she's not a gold digger, right? And so I drove that until I got a girlfriend, and then I hit another deer with it, and it was in such bad shape, it just wouldn't pass inspection anymore. So I bought another Cavalier, bought a 2001 Cavalier, two-door, Z24. It was a nice little car. That was the newest car I ever bought. That would have been, it would have been 6 years old. And bought it for $4,000, I think it was. $4,000 or $4,500. I think it was $4,000. I think I talked him down to that. $4,000. Drove that thing for 100,000 miles. See, people say, oh, you buy old cars, you know, you're going to nickel and dime, you're going to spend all this money on maintenance. Not my experience, anyway. Like, I've had less trouble with these old cars that I drive that I've known a lot of people to have with new cars. But anyway, drove that thing for several years until the timing chain was going bad in it, and it needed a bunch of work, and the power windows didn't work in it anymore. It had some weird steering problem. And it looked all right, but there was a lot of problems with it. It was going to take a lot of money to fix. And so I bought the Civic that you all remember. That was in 2011. It was a 2001 Civic. I bought a 10-year-old Civic, two-door, for $5,000. That is the most money I have ever spent on a car in my entire life, $5,000. That is 5, 10, or 15 times less than the most expensive car that most Americans buy. 5, 10, or 15 times less. 5 times would be 25, 10 would be 50, 15 would be 75,000, right? People spend that kind of money on cars all the time. That's the most expensive money I ever spent on a car. Drove that thing for 10 years, bought it with 136,000 miles on it, put 130-some thousand miles on it, had 270-something on it, I think. Drove it for all those years as a preacher. Drove that as a preacher. Preachers are supposed to be respectable, you know? Preachers are supposed to drive something that is becoming of the office, right? And I was a little self-conscious, a little apprehensive, like I'm driving this piece of junk, little two-door thing. I mean, it doesn't really look like I'm playing the part, right? But I got a vision. I got a goal. What am I going to waste money on cars for? And then Bev gave us this Malibu, and the Civic was getting pretty rough. I had to put oil in it every time I put gas in it. No kidding. Quart of oil every time I went to the gas station. So I got rid of that, and she gave me this car. This is, it would have been worth, I looked it up at the time, about $8,000. So if I would have bought it, it would be $8,000. So if I would, the car that I drive, the most expensive car I've ever driven was worth $8,000. Again, right? Like a fraction of what most people spend. And I'm hoping to make this thing last another 5 years. It is a 2011, so it's already, 14 years old. But hoping to make it last another 5 years. And if that's the case, in 30 years, I will have spent a grand total of about $20,000 on vehicles. If I would have bought the Malibu. Without buying the Malibu, a grand total of $12,000 in 30 years. If I would have bought the Malibu, a grand total of about $20,000 in 30 years. Most people would have spent like hundreds of thousands of dollars in 30 years on vehicles. That gives you an idea of, you know, why people are broke. So, that is just, I don't know if I had anything else to say, I've forgotten. That was the story I wanted to tell you. Now, I don't expect anybody to live like that. I mean, who wants to live like that? I'm not saying that you should or need to do that. But if you are willing to have some self-discipline and to forego things that other people will, right? You can stay out of debt and never have any debt for your whole life and then start saving and accruing money. So I just wanted to tell you that as an example to show you what is possible if you're willing to make the sacrifices and the hard decisions. I think that's all I'm going to say for today. I have a lot more in the outline, but it's been long enough, so I will pick it up again next week, Lord willing, and we'll talk about why we should save. And the Bible gives us a lot of reasons why we should save. And then I'm going to give you a bunch of statistics to show you what a mess all of our fellow countrymen are in financially. So I thank you for your kind and patient attention.